Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings, this is Abayomi Azikwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe. Today is Saturday, August 30th, 2014. We're broadcasting live from our studios here in downtown Detroit. And welcome back to all of our listeners to our program this week. We're broadcasting again this week from our studios in downtown Detroit. Last week, we had two remote broadcasts from the Detroit Marxism Conference that was held on August 23rd and 24th in Midtown Detroit. Today, we're broadcasting simultaneously with the Detroit International Jazz Festival, which is being held just a short distance away from where we're broadcasting in downtown Detroit. And, of course, we'll be coming up with our regular Pan-African Newswire reports, as well as other features of the Pan-African Journal. We'll be right back with more of this week's program.
Thank you.
And welcome back. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. And the Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. And I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. And today we are, of course, broadcasting live from our studios here in downtown Detroit. Today is August the 30th, Saturday, 2014. And our broadcast is taking place in proximity to the Detroit International Jazz Festival. This is the 35th year of that festival, which occurs over the Labor Day weekend here in the city of Detroit and downtown. And according to the schedule put out by the Detroit International Jazz Festival, it's going to feature a number of artists. Last night, the opening featured the artist in residence, Joshua Redman, who was performing with the Bad Plus Band. And Joshua Redman, of course, a well-known jazz saxophonist who will be performing on numerous occasions throughout the weekend. Also, this weekend, the festival will feature Randy Weston's African Rhythms. That's going to be tonight at 8:30. And others are going to be featured. Special tribute to Miles Davis from Wayne, featuring the Wallace Rooney with the orchestra. Featuring Wayne Shorter's Universe, Legend, and other rarely heard large jazz works. Of course, there will be Stanley Clark, the legendary jazz bassist. There's going to be a tribute to Nat King Cole, taking place on Sunday evening at 8:30, featuring Ramsey Lewis and John Pazzarilli. The Barry Harris Trio will also be playing from the city of Detroit, the Christian McBride Trio as well, Al Foster's Quartet. There will be a duo with Randy Weston and Billy Harper entitled The Roots of the Blues. Bill Evans, Soul Grass, will also be involved. Joey DeFrancesco's quartet, Lou Donaldson's organ quartet, as well as many others. So we are here in the city of Detroit today in commemoration along with the Detroit International Jazz Festival, which takes place every single year over the Labor Day weekend here in the city of Detroit. And right now we'll be right, we are here in downtown Detroit broadcasting live from our studios today, August 30th, Saturday, 2014. We'll be right back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week. Welcome back. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. We just heard the sound of John Coltrane from 1962 with the John Coltrane Quartet, and that was Song of the Underground Railroad. And we're here today, Saturday, August 30th, 2014, broadcasting live from our studios here in downtown Detroit. We're paying tribute to the annual Detroit International Jazz Festival, which is taking place this Labor Day weekend in the city of Detroit. This festival is in its 35th year, and we have been attending and covering the festival since yesterday when it began in the evening hours. Today it continues through Sunday as well as Monday, September the 1st. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. Right now, we're going to hear the sound of John Coltrane again, along with Miles Davis, a tune entitled Milestones. And welcome back. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. Today is Saturday, August the 30th, 2014. We're broadcasting live from our studios here in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to the Pan-African Journal for this week.
Lullaby of birdland, that's what I always hear when you sigh. Never in my wordland could there be ways to reveal in a phrase how I feel. Have you ever heard two turtle doves, Bill and Coo, when they love? That's the kind of magic music we make with our lips when we kiss. And there's a weepy old willow, he really knows how to cry. That's how I'd cry on my pillow if you should tell me farewell and goodbye. Lullaby of birdland, whisper low, kiss me sweet and we'll go flying high in birdland, high in the sky up above, all because we're in love.
In the next apartment, those stumbling words that told you what my heart meant. A fairground painted swing. These foolish things remind me of you. You came, you saw, you comforted me. When you did that to me, I knew somehow this had to be. the winds of March that made my heart a dancer. A telephone that rings, but who's to answer? Oh, how the ghost of you clings. These foolish things remind me of you. You came and you saw. That to me, don't you know I knew somehow it had to be the winds of March that made my heart a dancer, a telephone that rings, but who's to answer? Oh, how the ghost of you flees.
And that was the sound of Dinah Washington with These Foolish Things. Before that, we heard the voice of Sarah Vaughan and Lullaby in Birdland. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. Today is Saturday, August 30th, 2014. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. And this weekend is Labor Day weekend in the United States. And this weekend, the annual 35th Detroit International Jazz Festival is taking place in downtown in close proximity to where we're broadcasting from here in the city of Detroit. And later on, we're going to come up with our regular Pan-African Newswire report as well as the New York City version of the Pan-African Journal that is hosted by yours truly, Abayomi Ezekwe, and produced by Bernard White of Community Progressive Radio in New York City. We'll be right back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week.
Did you say I've got a lot to learn? Well, don't think I'm trying not to learn. Since this is the perfect spot to learn, ooh, teach me tonight. Let's start with the ABC of it. Roll right down to the XYZ of it. Help me solve the mystery of it. Teach me tonight. The sky's a blackboard high above you. If a shooting star goes by, one thing isn't very clear, my love. Should the teacher stand so near, my love? Graduation's almost here, my love. Come on and teach me tonight.
clear my love. Should the teacher stand so near my love? Graduation's almost here, my love. Teach me.
Thank you.
And welcome back. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. We just heard the sound of Bud Powell with Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and Charles Mingus on bass. And, of course, the bebop distinctive sound there from some of the pioneers of what became known as modern jazz music of the 1940s and 1950s. And this is Abayomi Ezekwe. You're tuned in to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. Today is Saturday, August 30th, 2014. We're broadcasting live from our studios here in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to the Pan-African Journal for this week. And right now we're going to move into our regular Pan-African Newswire Reports segment of the Pan-African Journal. And in this week's Pan-African Newswire, we're going to begin with developments in the Southern African nation of Lesotho. The Prime Minister of the Southern African Kingdom of Lesotho reportedly has fled to South Africa, alleging a coup by the military and saying his life was in danger. Speaking to the BBC, Thomas Tabane said he would return from South Africa, which surrounds Lesotho, quote, as soon as I know I am not going to get killed, unquote, he said. Reports say that the capital, Maseru, is now calm after soldiers seized buildings. The army denied staging a coup. Lesotho has seen a series of military coups since 1970. Mr. Tabane has headed a unity government since but suspended parliament session in June amid feuding in his coalition. He denied accusations that his actions had undermined his government. Mr. Tabane said the army had rendered the government, quote, dysfunctional, unquote, an action that amounted to a coup. Quote, I have been removed from control, not by the people, but by the armed forces, and that is illegal, unquote, he said. He also said, I came into South Africa this morning, and I will return as soon as my life is not in danger. I will not go back to Lesotho to get killed, unquote, he said. Now, at the scene of the conflict was Basildone Peta, who is in Maseru, the capital of Lesotho. According to a correspondent and publisher of the Lesotho Times newspaper, Basildone Peta, said that this whole thing started around 3 o'clock. There were gunshots since early morning. The city is currently calm. People are playing. It's safe within their homes, but there's basically a media blackout. To all intents and purposes, it is a military coup with the aim of ousting the prime minister. There can be no other reason for soldiers behaving the way they have been behaving other than to seize power. So far, we have no reports of killings. It will be correct to call it a bloodless coup attempt, but I am not going to stick around. The chances are the situation may deteriorate. One does not know what is going to happen. And that was from Basildone Peta, who is the publisher of the Lesotho Times newspaper. Additional reports say that the army is understood to have acted earlier after the prime minister attempted to remove its chief, Lieutenant General Kennedy Clay Kamodi. The army said the general was still in charge, saying the military, quote, supports the democratically elected government of the day, unquote, Reuters news agency has reported. A spokesman, Major Ndede Ntoy, denied staging a coup, saying, quote, there's nothing like that. The situation has returned to normalcy. The military has returned to their barracks, unquote. Earlier, troops were seen on the streets of Maseru, the capital, and there were reports of gunfire. Our radio stations were taken off the air, and phone lines were cut, although later reports suggested they were working again. Sports Minister Sidide Masaraban told the Agence France-Presse news agency that troops had surrounded the State House, a key government building. And other reports from the Southern African nation of Lesotho says that the military seized control of the African Kingdom's police headquarters and jammed radio stations and phones in the early hours today, Saturday, August the 30th, 2014. A government minister and member of the ruling coalition told the Agence France-Presse, the AFP, quote, The armed forces, the special forces of Lesotho, have taken the headquarters of the police, unquote. That's according to sports minister and leader of the Basotho National Party, Teh Sidi Maserebani. He said, describing a possible coup attempt in the small nation located in eastern southern Africa, quote, at 4 o'clock this morning, they were driving around the residence of the prime minister and my residence, unquote, he said. He went on to say that, quote, they have been some gunfighting since 4 a.m. up until 7 or 8 a.m. Quote, they've jammed phones, they have jammed everything, unquote, he added. Maserebani said he fled hours earlier after being warned. Quote, the commander said he was looking for me, the prime minister and the deputy minister, to take us to the king. In our country, that means a coup, unquote, he added. He insisted Prime Minister Tom Tabani's government was still in control. Quote, the prime minister and myself, we are still the coalition government. The prime minister is still in power, unquote. Tabani was, quote, fine, unquote. He added, declining to elaborate where the prime minister was. Quote, there's still a lot of danger. People who have arms are running around Maseru, unquote. The government secretary was unreachable for comment. A shaky coalition government has governed Lesotho, which is entirely surrounded by the Republic of South Africa. The coalition government has been in control since the national elections some 2 years ago. Coalition partners patched up the fragile deal through mediators just this last past June. And we're going to bring you additional information related to political developments in the Southern African nation of Lesotho later on in our program, the Pan-African Journal. You're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. In the West African nation of Nigeria, buoyed by their recent gains and capture of communities in Borno State, the Boko Haram gunmen, operating in over three dozen Toyota Hilux vehicles and motorcycles at dawn on Thursday, August the 28th, invaded Dikwa town in the state, forcing many residents, including the Shehu of Dikwa, Muhammad Mas II Ibn Alamin El Kanami, to flee to Mataguru and other border villages with Cameroon. Dikwa is a border council headquarters and 85 kilometers northeast of Mataguru, the state capital. Although there were no reported loss of lives and property, Modu Bukar, who fled to Mataguri on Wednesday morning, August the 27th, said some residents were scattered in different directions because of the insurgents. Quote, some of us had to flee last night along with members of our families to safer places like Mataguri. These gunmen are never to be trusted because they will say one thing today, and the following day they change and commence slitting people's throats but not joining to fight their own cause. Quote, their capture of towns and villages in Borno continued on Wednesday, August the 27th, with the invasion of our town, the headquarters of Dikwa, a border town with Cameroon, unquote, Bukar said. He recounted how Dikwa was invaded. Quote, there were sounds of explosions and gunfire heralding their arrival in this town, and some of us immediately fled for fear of the unknown. The Shehu of Dikwa also fled his palace along with his family members and courtiers, unquote. He also claimed that the insurgents took over the town and hoisted their flag with little resistance from security forces. Military sources said on Wednesday, August the 27th, that Mataguri also confirmed the incident, stating that there were attempts by suspected insurgents to attack one of the border towns in northern Borno last night. Quote, as at the time of receiving this report from Dikwa last night, there were no casualties on both civilians and property. The insurgents are on a rampage of claiming some towns and villages in Borno State, unquote, the military source said. The invasion of Dikwa brings to 16 towns and villages already captured, including Goza, Marti, Aska, Shia, Wulgo, Banki, and Gamburu in central and southern parts of Borno State, located in northeast Nigeria. The Nigerian military had earlier dismissed Boko Haram's declaration of a, quote, Islamic caliphate, unquote. as, quote, empty, unquote, insisting that no part of Nigeria would be conceded to the insurgents. Also yesterday on August the 27th, according to this report issued on August the 28th, the Nigerian Air Force fighter jets bombed selected targets in Gwozo areas in an attempt to reclaim the captured council headquarters from the insurgents. And finally, people of the Gaza Strip continued festivities for victory against the Israeli regime after 7 weeks of aggression on Palestinians. That's according to a report issued by Press TV on Saturday, August the 30th. On Friday, August the 29th, the Palestinian resistance group Islamic Jihad staged a parade and rally in Gaza City to mark the victory following 50 days of fighting. The demonstrators praised armed resistance against the recent Israeli onslaught. Quote, Israel was broken during this war, and the resistance fighters you see standing around here are determined to fight with the Zionist enemy until the complete liberation of Palestine, unquote, said Daoud Shahab, a senior Islamic official at the demonstration. Quote, we kept fighting until the last minute before the start of the truce, and we will continue to train and equip our forces until the next battle with the enemy, unquote, Shahab said. The Egyptian brokered truce, which took effect after Cairo's negotiations on Tuesday, stipulated that the ease of Israeli 7-year blockade, as well as the provision of a guarantee that Palestinians' demands will be met. Israeli warplanes and tanks started pounding and blockading enclaves in early July, inflicting heavy losses on the Palestinians in Gaza. Nearly 2,140 Palestinians, mostly civilians, including women and children, were killed in 50 days of the Israeli onslaught on Gaza. Around 11,000 others were injured in the bombings and in the ground assault. Tel Aviv says 69 Israelis were killed in the conflict, but Hamas puts the number at being much higher. And with that, we're going to conclude this week's Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. We'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service designed to foster intelligent discussion on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998 and has published thousands of articles and dispatches and newspapers and magazines in journals and research reports and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. And if you want to log on to the Pan-African Newswire, all you have to do is go to the following URL, and that's at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And in doing that, you can, of course, stay tuned to some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day. And this is Abayomi Ezekwe. We'll be right back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week. We'll be right back. Welcome back. That was the legendary sound of the Clifford Brown Max Roach quintet with Clifford Brown on trumpet, Max Roach on drums, Ed Morrill on bass, Richie Powell on piano, and Harold Land on tenor saxophone. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe, and today is Saturday, August 30th, 2014. We're broadcasting live from our studios here in downtown Detroit, broadcasting simultaneously this weekend with the Detroit International Jazz Festival, the 35th in a series of international jazz festivals are held annually in the city of Detroit during the Labor Day weekend here in the United States. And as we mentioned earlier, many leading the jazz field will be performing in Detroit this weekend, including Detroit's own Barry Harris Trio, as well as Randy Weston, Billy Harper, the Gary Burton Quintet, the Al Foster Quartet. There'll also be Lou Donaldson's Organ Quartet. And the Walter White Quartet will also be performing at this week's ends of Detroit International Jazz Festival. There's going to be a tribute to Nat King Cole featuring Ramsey Lewis and John Pazzarelli, as well as a tribute to Miles Davis featuring trumpeter Wallace Rooney, as well as an orchestra featuring Wayne Shorter's Universe, as well as other leading jazz musicians. Ron Carter, who formerly played with Miles Davis many decades ago, will be performing as well in a tribute to guitarist Jim Hall and Dr. Lonnie Smith in the beginning octet will also be on hand. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe. Right now, let's listen to the voice of the voiceless, Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The real outside agitators. As the days and nights of angry resistance rage on in Ferguson, Missouri, the corporate media embarks on its newest campaign, the proposed banning of outside agitators. It is ironic in the extreme to hear black reporters and black cops and indeed black activists launch a verbal attack against outside agitators when, were it not for such protesters during the hottest days and nights of the civil rights movement, they would not exist. For the phrase outside agitators was born in the minds and mouths of white southern segregationists who decried the arrival of white and black students from the north who worked to register voters, found freedom schools, and joined the Freedom Riders on buses to break state segregation laws. Remember the Southern Christian Leadership Conference? That's Martin King's organization. When SCLC staged marches in Alabama, that state's governor, George Wallace, called SCLC, quote, professional agitators with pro-communist affiliations, unquote. Sound familiar? How close to outside agitators? The phrase begs the question, outside of what? The state? America? This country is called the United States of America, founded upon a constitution. Do all people have the right to protest, or just certain residents? Is what happened to Mike Brown a local matter, or is this really a national issue? It's not the job of media to police protests, pitting good demonstrators against bad ones. Their job is to report, period. Were it not for these protests, let us be frank, the media would have ignored the story. If the media was doing its job, reporting on the vicious state violence launched against young blacks the nation over, perhaps Mike Brown would be alive today. Let us look at the cops, almost 98% of whom are outside and outsiders to Ferguson. They work there, they kill there, but they don't live there. They dwell in neighboring whiter counties and towns. Who are the real outside agitators? from imprisoned nation. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And that was the voice of the voiceless, Mumia Abu-Jamal, asking the question in light of the rebellions in Ferguson, who are the real outside agitators? And right now, we're going to move into our Pan-African Newswire New York City version that was aired just this last past Monday, August the 25th, over a community progressive radio in New York City. The program is hosted, of course, by yours truly, Abayomi Ezekwe, the editor of the Pan-African Newswire. And this program, the New York City version of the Pan-African Newswire and the Pan-African Journal, is produced by Bernard White of CPR Metro. Let's listen in. Greetings once again. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. Welcome back to the Pan-African Journal for this week. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. In this week's program, we're going to be discussing the unrest that has rocked Ferguson, Missouri over the last 2.5 weeks. Inside Ferguson itself, the people of that community have been in an uproar over the police murder of Michael Brown. Yet at the same time, the corporate media, as well as the authorities in Ferguson, are attempting to criminalize not only Michael Brown and his associates, but the entire African-American community, as well as the anti-racist movement in general. In the North African state of Libya, some 3 years after the Central Intelligence Agency, Pentagon, and NATO war of regime change that toppled the Jemahiriya headed by Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, the country has plunged into deeper chaos. An Islamist militia claims they are in control of the airport as well as major areas of the capital of Tripoli. The Israeli war against the people of Gaza is continuing. Earlier last week, three commanders of the military wing of Hamas were assassinated. In the last several days, a number of buildings have been bombed. And finally, the Iraq war is escalating once again. President Barack Obama has ordered more airstrikes against Iraq, as well as the deployment of ground forces. The Missouri city of Ferguson has drawn attention to the ongoing racism, racist violence, and national oppression of the African-American people in the United States. In Ferguson, demonstrations have been going on for 2.5 weeks in the aftermath of the brutal killing of Michael Brown. And also, it has come to light recently that the police officer who killed Michael Brown had been previously a part of a police force that was disbanded allegedly over racial tensions. The officer who shot Michael Brown 6 times on August the 9th was a former member of the Jennings Police Department, which its city council disbanded in 2011 over corruption and racial tension among its residents. Wilson reportedly did not have any disciplinary issues with the department, but all 45 officers were fired. Now, according to the New York Daily News from Sunday, August the 24th, the cop who shot Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, once worked for this troubled police department that was deemed to be so out of shape that, in fact, it was disbanded. Darren Wilson, who has been on paid administrative leave from the Ferguson Police Department following his fatal shooting of 18-year-old African-American Michael Brown, has been hidden from the public view and not spoken out despite the enormous amount of attention the August 9th incident has received locally, nationally, as well as internationally. Much of the discussion of the incident has been about the tensions between the predominantly white police department in predominantly African-American communities. And a profile on the officer in the Washington Post reveals Ferguson was not the first time Wilson had to deal with these issues in his career. You're dealing with white cops, and they don't know how to address black people. The newspaper reports Wilson was employed by the small town of Jennings, Missouri, whose officer's relationship with the public was so bad, the city council decided to take the highly unusual step of firing all of its 45 officers some 3 years ago. The, quote, straw that broke the camel's back, unquote, was when an officer who was not Wilson chased a woman outside the city limits and shot her vehicle with a child in the back seat. Now, Rodney Epps, an African-American city council member in Jennings, told the New York Daily News. He said that you're dealing with white cops and they don't know how to address black people, Epps told the Washington Post. Wilson then went to work at Ferguson, where he was not, according to official accounts, has not had any disciplinary action and received a commendation by the Ferguson Council for subduing a man involved in an alleged drug transaction, the newspaper reports. But he appeared to have family issues growing up as his parents divorced when he was a toddler in Texas. He later moved to St. Peter's, Missouri, and his mother, who in 2001 pleaded guilty to forgery and stealing, died when Wilson was just 16 years old. And that's some background information on Darren Wilson, who in fact has had a movement come up in recent days, largely among pro-police officers, organizations, to defend him from any potential indictments. Although it's been 2 weeks since the gunning down of young 18-year-old Michael Brown, there has been no indictments and no arrest of the white police officer. Now, prompting the entire controversy surrounding Ferguson, Missouri, was the militarized response of the Ferguson and the St. Louis County Police, the deployment of the National Guard by Democratic Governor Jay Nixon, the utilization of high-powered rifles and automatic weapons, and also the deployment of tear gas, pepper spray, bean bags, rubber bullets, and live ammunition against largely unarmed and peaceful protesters. Now, in response to this, United States President Barack Obama has ordered an investigation into whether it is appropriate for the military to sell battle-grade hardware to local police forces. This is according to a senior United States official. The order follows widespread criticisms of local authorities' use of military gear in Ferguson, Missouri, after the fatal shooting of unarmed African-American teenager Michael Brown by a white police officer. Images of police welding military-style guns and armor during clashes with protesters have shocked many American lawmakers and civil rights organizations. The official said Mr. Obama, quote, has directed a review of federal programs and funding that enable state and local law enforcement to purchase military equipment, unquote. The review will consider, quote, whether these programs are appropriate, unquote, whether training with equipment is sufficient, and whether there is enough federal oversight of the gears used. The investigation will be headed by, quote, White House staff, including the Domestic Policy Council, the National Security Council, and the Office of Management and Budget, unquote, the official said. A growing number of lawmakers have voiced concern about the militarization of the United States police forces through programs administered by the Pentagon, the Justice Department, and the Department of Homeland Security. Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri, who heads the Oversight Subcommittee of the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee, announced plans this week for a hearing in September about the programs. Key concerns include a clause in the program that requires police to use the equipment within a year, something the American Civil Liberties Union argues may give police forces an incentive to use the equipment in inappropriate situations. The program also does not mandate training for crowd control or other uses. The Pentagon has transferred more than $4 billion In fact, some $4.2 billion of equipment, including armored vehicles, tents, rifles, night vision goggles to local and state agencies since 2006, of which about 36% involved brand new equipment. Now, U.S. weapons makers have been eyeing what they call, quote, adjacent, unquote, markets for years, keen to drum up fresh demand for products initially developed for the military, and recently to offset declines in the United States and European military spending. Faced with a dwindling number of big-ticket military contracts, even the Pentagon's largest suppliers, such as Lockheed Martin Corporation, Northrop Grumman Corporation, are competing for increasingly smaller contracts in commercial or non-military markets, analysts and industry executives have said. Meanwhile, demonstrators in Ferguson have marked 2 weeks since Mr. Brown's death, holding quieter protests as supporters of the officer rallied separately, calling the shooting justified. Mr. Brown's funeral is set for Monday, August the 25th. It is likely to be a focal point for more mass demonstrations by demonstrators and protesters demanding that Darren Wilson, the policeman who pulled the shot and the teenager and placed the 6 bullets in his body, is a fact people are demanding that he face justice. Little information has been released about the investigation into the shooting, and a grand jury began hearing evidence just this last past Wednesday in a process the counter prosecutor said could run until mid-October. And according to Press TV, protesters inside the United States state of Missouri have held a vigil to pray and mark 2 weeks since a white police officer shot dead an unarmed African-American teenager. The demonstrators gathered in intense heat on Saturday, August the 23rd, in the city of Ferguson, where 18-year-old Michael Brown was fatally shot by Darren Wilson on August the 9th. Ferguson has been the scene of violent clashes between police and protesters since the shooting of Brown, who was shot 6 times and killed by police in the predominantly African-American suburb. It was the third straight night of disorderly and as well as orderly protests after previous demonstrations descended into standoffs with the police, who fired tear gas and bean bags and rubber bullets and pepper spray to disperse mass demonstrations in the night as well as during the day. Little information has been released about the investigation of the fatal shooting that has divided the black and white communities in the region. On Saturday, a group of people held a separate rally in support of the killer cop in Ferguson. Meanwhile, authorities are bracing for a possible flare-up of unrest ahead of Brown's funeral on Monday, or perhaps after his funeral on Monday. Nonetheless, police have come under fire for arresting hundreds of demonstrators and for using heavy-handed tactics. Brown's death has reignited the national debate surrounding race and police brutality in the United States. Civil rights activists say the United States has a strong degree of institutionalized racism against African Americans and other nationally oppressed groups. And of course, this debate has been continuing, not just in Ferguson, Missouri, but throughout the United States. On Saturday, August the 23rd, thousands of people marched in New York City to denounce the U.S. police discrimination against African Americans and to protest the chokehold death of an unarmed African American by a white police officer. The march was dubbed, quote, "We will not go back," unquote. It began on Saturday afternoon in Staten Island, where 43-year-old Eric Garner died after New York City police put him in a banned chokehold on July the 17th. The rally was led by many community leaders, and it culminated at the office of the Staten Island District Attorney, Daniel Donovan, who just this last past week sent the case to a grand jury. The protesters walked behind a banner that read, "We will not go back, march for justice." Garner's death has reignited more of a national debate in the United States about police use of excessive force, particularly on people who are not white. Quote, "We are not here to cause riots. We are here because violence was caused," unquote, said Al Sharpton, leader of the National Action Network. and of course the former New York Governor David Paterson, a number of civil rights leaders, and Garner's widow, Esau, also attended the rally. Quote, "Let's make this a peaceful march and get justice for my husband so that this doesn't happen to anybody else," unquote, Esau Garner said in a somber speech to the crowd. The protest was also in response to the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. Demonstrators carried signs calling for justice for Garner and Brown and shouted slogans including, "Hands up, don't shoot. Hands up, don't shoot." This has become somewhat of a mantra across the United States among African Americans and progressive forces who are demanding justice for Michael Brown, for Eric Garner, and for countless other victims of police brutality and police terrorism. African Americans and other nationally oppressed groups in New York City say they feel unfairly targeted by police for suspicions of petty crimes. Garner, a 43-year-old father of six, suffered from asthma and was unarmed when he was stopped by police in Staten Island for allegedly selling loose cigarettes on the streets. After resisting arrest, Garner was placed in a chokehold by white New York Police Department officer Daniel Pataleo and can be heard in a cell phone video screaming, quote, "I can't breathe," unquote, several times as he was forced to the ground and handcuffed. The confrontation led to his death a short time later. The city medical examiner ruled the death a homicide, and the New York Police Department officer Pataleo and Justin D'Amico have been reassigned during the investigation. Sharpton and other activists have demanded that Staten Island District Attorney Daniel Donovan bring criminal charges against the officers and have called for the United States Justice Department to step in. The shooting death of Brown by Ferguson City Police Officer Darren Wilson on August 9th has also sparked outrage and protest across the nation, including nightly protests in Ferguson. Civil rights activists say Brown's death followed years of police targeting of African Americans. So from New York City to Ferguson, Missouri, to Los Angeles, California, and to other areas of the United States, the blatant and violent and deadly repression against the African-American people continue. And with that, we're going to take a brief break. We'll be right back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week. And welcome back. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. In the state of Texas, another incident of police misconduct came to light on Friday, August the 22nd. In an article published in the New York Daily News, it notes that there were officers in the state of Texas that pulled over the vehicle of Kametra Barber. Kametra Barber's car was loaded up with small children, two of her own and two of her godchildren. Her hands were above her head, then shackled in cuffs. Moments later, her six-year-old son, Ryan, comes out, too, with his hands up. Texas police mistakenly pulled over and arrested the woman, scarring her four children in the car and including a six-year-old boy who exited the vehicle with his hands up. Dashboard footage from the officer's car in Forney, Texas, was released to TV stations WFAA. The officers were searching for a beige or tan Toyota with four African-American males after authorities were alerted a gun was pointed out of the window. Police pulled over a burgundy-red Nissan Maxima driven by Kametra Barber on August the 9th, ironically the same day as Michael Brown was gunned down in Ferguson, Missouri. This vehicle was spotted in the same area as the other car, the station reported. Sir, what is going on? Oh, my God, you will terrify my children, Barbara said. Barbara was immediately pulled out of the car and handcuffed with her four children inside. Quote, yes, sir, what is wrong? My kids, they are 6 and 8 and 10 and 9. What are we doing? Unquote, she asked. Quote, sir, what is going on? Oh, my God, you will terrify my children, unquote. After his mother was pulled away, 6-year-old Ryan could be seen exiting the car and walking to the officers with his hands up. The cops had been looking for a tan or beige vehicle carrying 4 African-American men, but pulled over Barbara's reddish vehicle carrying her and her 4 children. Barbara's 6-year-old son, Ryan, put his hands up and approached the police. Barbara had been driving with her 4 children when she was pulled over by police. Police had to calm the children in the car and guarantee to them that they weren't going to jail. Police can be heard on the tape recognizing the children were too young and did not match the description they had been given. They can also be seen trying to calm the screaming children in the car and assured them no one will be going to jail. A phony detective told the station the officers' actions were appropriate due to the seriousness of the call they were investigating. Barbara told the station she understood the officers made quick decisions, but is still bothered by what happened. Quote, I need you to make sure you have all the facts, because you can't just say, okay, I'm sorry, and then I'm over it, unquote, she said. She went on to say that, quote, I can't. Every time I listen to and hear or think about it, it bothers me. I can't just say, I'm fine. It's okay. It's not a big deal. It is, unquote. And that was a report on developments involving police brutality way down in the state of Texas. Now, just this last past week, as a result of the unrest that has gripped the city of Ferguson in Missouri, there's been much reflection and analysis about what the police murder of Michael Brown really means to race relations and the overall political culture of the United States. Michael Brown, an 18-year-old African-American youth, was shot at least 6 times by a Ferguson, Missouri white police officer, Darren Wilson, according to preliminary results of an independent autopsy requested by the family. The fatal shot went directly through the top of Brown's head into his brain, killing him immediately. There are numerous eyewitnesses to the killing of Michael Brown. A cell phone videotape captured the scene minutes after the youth was gunned down in the streets while police stood around talking. When Brown's family members attempted to take a look at the body, they were pushed away by the Ferguson police. The name of the officer was not released until 6 days after the shooting. On the same day as Wilson's name was released, a video was also issued by local authorities in Ferguson, which purportedly showed someone resembling Brown taking a box of cigars from a store and pushing a clerk. The contents of this video and the timing of its release further inflamed tensions in the African-American community. On the evening of August the 15th, after the release of the video attempting to criminalize Brown, the store in question was trashed. This took place a day after the St. Louis County Police were ostensibly pulled back while being criticized for its brutal actions against demonstrators, community members, and even members of the media. Governor Jay Nixon, a Democrat, supposedly made the decision to lighten up on the police repression. He was called by President Barack Obama, who was attempting to reduce the damage these developments have had on local, state, and federal governments in the United States. Nevertheless, by the morning of August the 16th, riot police units were called back into the unrest areas in Ferguson. On the evening of August the 17th, police claimed they were fired on and attempts were made to put up barricades to hold back law enforcement and to overrun the command center. These claims were made in an effort to justify further repression. Governor Nixon announced that he was deploying the National Guard in an effort to quell the unrest. A curfew was imposed on August the 15th, resulting in mass efforts to defy the orders that people leave the streets by midnight. On August the 17th, militarized police units attacked the people gathered in the streets more than 2 hours before the curfew was scheduled to go into effect. Nixon announced that the curfew would be lifted on the evening of August the 18th, but the National Guard would be deployed to maintain order. Brown was wounded 4 times in his shoulder and arm, with an additional bullet going through his mouth. The fatal wound was apparently the final one, which takes on the dimension of a execution-style killing. At a press conference held in Ferguson, called by the family of Michael Brown, attorney Benjamin Crump acted as the chief spokesman and conveyed 3 questions being asked by Leslie McSpadden, the mother of 18-year-old student Michael Brown, who was struck down on August the 9th while walking to his grandmother's home. McSpadden wanted to know how many times her son was shot, or whether Brown suffered prior to his death, and finally, why hasn't the police officer who killed her child been arrested? Quote, "It verifies the worst that the family thinks happened, that he was executed," unquote, Crump told the news conference on August the 18th. He went on to say, "It confirms what the witnesses said, that this was an execution," unquote. Crump served as a lawyer for the family of Trayvon Martin, who was killed by George Zimmerman in February of 2013. Like Brown, his death galvanized African-American communities across the United States and prompted world news coverage of the killings and demonstrations organized to seek justice. President Barack Obama has spoken out twice on the situation in Ferguson. During his vacation on Martha's Vineyard, on August the 14th, he was compelled to address the crisis after 6 days of mass demonstrations, both nonviolent and violent. Obama said that the U.S. was, quote, "one country with common values," unquote, and that the situation in Ferguson must be resolved through peaceful means, admonishing those who engage in attacks on private property and the police. Nonetheless, if the United States was one country, then there would not be periodic urban rebellions throughout African-American communities nationwide. Many of these outbreaks are fueled by blatant acts of police misconduct and brutality. The situation in Ferguson is by no means an isolated incident. Since the times of slavery, Africans have resisted national oppression, racist violence, and economic exploitation. To suggest that both the oppressed and the oppressor have equal responsibility in a situation that was clearly provoked by the police, the authorities in St. Louis County, and the state of Missouri is disingenuous, to say the least. In a second press conference on August the 18th, after Obama's return to the White House, he mentioned the situation in Ferguson again. Initially, however, as on August the 14th, he discussed the current U.S. military intervention in northern Iraq through aerial bombardment and ground operations. Obama sought to justify the deployment of U.S. military advisors and fighter jets in Iraq over the last several weeks. He said the civilians were being threatened and the self-proclaimed Islamic State needed to be curtailed and contained. The president never acknowledged the role of the United States in destabilizing Iraq and creating the conditions for sectarianism. The so-called Islamic State, formerly known as the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or the Islamic State of Syria and the Levant, has been fighting against the government in Syria on the same side as Washington, which is committed to overthrowing the presidency of Bashar al-Assad. When asked during the question and answer period whether he had any reservations about the militarization of the police, where they are given hundreds of millions of dollars in defense equipment utilized in war zones, the president refused to address this inquiry directly. Obama made reference to the aftermath of 9/11 as a reason for militarization. However, the situation in Ferguson is not at all similar to the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon in 2001. It was the actions of a white police officer, a department where he works, a county law enforcement militarized response, and the governor who has refused to address the oppressive conditions under which African Americans live and instead sent the National Guard to suppress the the mass response to an injustice. In addition, as the only programmatic response to the questions about the social conditions of African-American youth in contemporary U.S. society, Obama only discussed his so-called My Brother's Keepers project, which in essence places the onus of responsibility for living in a racist capitalist society on the victims themselves, not providing any assistance from the federal government and the corporate institutions which are at the root of the mass unemployment, underemployment, poverty, and incarceration prevalent among tens of millions of African Americans. Obama said that many people of color do not feel they are part of the broader society. The fact is, African Americans and other nationally oppressed groups are not treated equally and are systematically discriminated against, which manifests itself through disparate treatment due to their race and social class. Until these issues are corrected, unrest, both nonviolent and violent, will continue throughout the United States. To advance demands for self-determination, national liberation, and full equality on a political level, it requires the mass organization of the oppressed, an alliance with the working class as a whole. The only way racism and national oppression can be uprooted and destroyed in U.S. society is to fundamentally transform the system of racial capitalism. And with that, we're going to take another break. We'll be right back with an update on developments in Gaza and the attacks by the Israeli Defense Forces against the Palestinian people.
All the civil rights leaders, for various reasons, refuse or can't take a stand or have to go along with the administration. That's their business. But I'm afraid tonight that I know that justice is indivisible. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
And welcome back. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. And I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. And tensions are continuing in the Gaza region of Palestine. In an article in the Haaretz newspaper published in Israel, it says that on the night of August the 5th, Gaza's interior and national security minister posted a comment on his Facebook page decrying the damage caused by publishing names and photographs of, quote, resistance fighters who fell in battle, unquote, the Shahids, along with information on where they died. The Israeli military spokesman seized on this comment as a smoking gun, proof that Hamas was deliberately concealing militant fatalities to boost the apparent numbers of civilians killed. The Israeli Defense Forces cannot refute the images of dead women and children that are broadcast abroad. So instead, the army is trying to construct a narrative proving that its targets and the aftermath of its attacks are legitimate. The MIRA, Amit Intelligence and Terrorism Information Center, is a vital partner in constructing this narrative. The center, which is checking the name of each Palestinian said killed in the Gaza fighting, it has gotten to 450 so far, estimate that some 46% of them are, quote, terrorist operatives, unquote. This figure may change in accordance with further investigations. The center's lists are accompanied by photographs of posters and death notices of some of the militants. Each name is marked, quote, non-involved, unquote, or, quote, unidentified, unquote, or, quote, terrorist operative, unquote. The source for the information of each person's, quote, involvement, unquote, is not mentioned, apart from operatives whose photograph appears in death notices or public reports of the Hamas organization to which he belonged. Hamas's military wing has released few of the names of its own operatives, though it did announce the deaths of the senior military leaders who had been on Israel's wanted list for many years. Raed Attar, Mohammed Abu Shamale, and Mohammed Bahoum, who were assassinated in Gaza just last week. If concealing the names of fatalities is really part of Hamas's propaganda strategy, a way of forging a counter-narrative to that of the Israeli Defense Forces, then it contradicts the deep Palestinian and Hamas ethos of pride over those who were killed fighting the Zionist enemy. Quote, Even if Hamas had decided to hide the names of his fallen combatants and their numbers for a long time, the families wouldn't agree, unquote, a veteran Hamas activist told Haaretz newspaper. He said, ultimately, everything will come to light. Quote, now we don't know if they are fighters who were killed in the tunnels and are still buried there, or if they are living in the tunnels. They are bodies that has been under the rubble for so long that they are unrecognizable, unquote, he said. The IDF and the Ahmad Center saw the Palestinian Facebook comment as a warning and an instruction not to release information for propaganda purposes. But Palestinians saw it as an expression of concern. Releasing the casualties' names would enable Israel to target their families as well by bombing their homes, thus turning even more civilians into, quote, targets, unquote, or, quote, collateral damage, unquote. This is not propaganda. It is the reality in which 1.8 Palestinians have been living in for the last 6 weeks. Quote, the occupation gathers this information and testimonies and uses them to excuse its crimes against the civilians and destroy the homes, unquote, the Palestinian Facebook post says. The Israeli Defense Forces English translation of the post omits the words, quote, against the civilians and destroy their homes, unquote. The IDF itself is well-versed in hiding information about the exact location of rocket landings for security, not propaganda reasons. Hamas also has military considerations in not mentioning where its people were killed. The concern for civilians is justified. The Gazan human rights organization, Mizan, reported that 952 people have been killed in their bombarded homes, including 307 children and 204 women, including two disabled women who are in a bombarded rehabilitation center. On Thursday of last week, 50 civilians were added to the list, including Hassan Yunus, an 80-year-old father of Mizan director Issam Yunus and his wife. The 12, quote, accurate, unquote, missiles fired at dawn were aimed at a neighbor's house in the Tel Sultan neighborhood, home of three Is al-Din al-Qassam fugitives. So far, B. Salem has documented 72 direct bombardments that have destroyed buildings and killed their inhabitants. Of the 547 people killed in these strikes, 125 were women under 60, 250 were minors, and 29 were men and women aged 60 or older. Beth Salam also gives the name of an operative in Hamas's military wing who was killed in the bombing. The Israeli Defense Forces does not say why these 72 buildings were bombed with their inhabitants inside. While it took the trouble to warn hundreds of other families a few minutes before bombing their homes. In any case, targeting 72 buildings directly and striking them with no warning cannot be excused as a mistake. The Israeli Defense Forces does not explain what the acceptable rate of collateral damage is or how many people is it okay to kill in order to assassinate a single alleged Hamas armed combatant. As of Thursday of last week, 76.8% of the 2,090 fatalities documented by Mizan have been civilians. The United Nations team preliminary examination showed on Wednesday of last week that 71% of the fatalities of 1,434 out of 1,999 are civilians. The United Nations team, Palestinian human rights organizations, and Beth Shalom are examining every fatality, seeing every body in the hospital, checking every death report, and talking to eyewitnesses, family members, and survivors. It's enormous, difficult work, emotionally and physically. Despite their experience, no one is trained to witness 10, 50, 100 corpses, among them dismembered children, day after day. It's work that often involves risking one's own life, done mostly without electricity or enough water. When making an initial identification, even as the shelling continues and bodies pile up, that were retrieved only after several days. There are details that field investigators cannot get to. A sizable Gaza City, it is hard to figure out immediately people's background and their cause of death. In Rafia, the task was proven to be much easier. Because the documenting organizations work separately, the numbers vary. Mizan, and three other non-governmental organizations, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, El Haq, and Al Damir Institution for Human Rights, assembled a joint team that works on cross-reference information, double-checking identities, confirming identities with the population registry, and affirming the circumstances of death. Renewing fighting on Tuesday of last week and the constant addition of dead and injured put an end to this joint activity. When the investigations renew, the teams will continue their work of dividing the date on those killed between fighters and civilians. Staff members for Mizan and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights were careful not to include in their list people who were executed as Israeli collaborators. So far, these casualties, or some of them, were included in the health ministry list and not declared publicly as killed. Mizan and the Palestinian Center investigators understood that whoever was shot in the head at close range in a neighborhood that the IDF came nowhere near to cannot be counted. On the other hand, as members of that society, they are able to distinguish in the end between those who really were fighters with a long-standing role in one of the militants' groups, those who were just waving flags at a rally or a funeral, those who were presented as fighters because of family or political circumstances, or those who had just joined a group a month earlier and had yet to learn to fire a gun. Satellite images and collaborator intelligence allows the Shin Bet and the IDF to define them as active terrorists. But investigators from the United Nations and the Palestinian non-governmental organizations do not bend their divisions to the very flexibility and non-transparent categorizations of the Shin Bet and the IDF. Dr. Atif Abu Saif, a political science professor at Gaza's Al-Azhar University, researched the impact of drones on life in Gaza. He found that the targets for Israeli military missile attacks for years were determined not only by exact intelligence in the field, as the IDF claims, but by suspicious behavior. Examples include riding a motorcycle associated with armed groups or hanging out on roofs associated with lookouts. Anwar Zanin, a Mizan investigator, was killed in early August by a missile after riding a motorcycle to see if he could fix a water pipe in his home in Beit Hanun. Some journalists have challenged the United Nations and the Palestinian categorizations, asserting that the number of young men killed in Gaza was relatively high compared to their size within the population. The conclusion is that most of them, the men killed, and they are the right age to be engaged in a Hamas activity, were indeed so-called militants. This conclusion is faulty, and not being aware that the public space in Palestinian society in general, and in Gaza in particular, is appropriated mainly by men. The men go to the mosque early in the morning and the evening. Only men go to funerals. Men sit outside their homes on hot days and watch World Cup games. And men are the ones who run out to retrieve the wounded and dead immediately after an attack or go to get water during an attack. So it's natural that the number of men killed would be higher relative to the population, and not only because this is the right age to join the fighting. The attempt to undermine the figures provided by independent Palestinian groups who are more familiar than anyone else with the territory and to present them as false or distorted. In part of this war, the Palestinian organizations are waiting for the moment international inquiries committees start their probe. That's why they are determined to be as accurate in their findings as possible. They want to see an end to what they view as a tradition of not punishing Israel for flouting international law. That was a report from an Israeli newspaper, Haaretz, on how the politics of death is calculated and interpreted by the Israeli Defense Forces. And also in Gaza, the Israeli Air Force struck a 13-story building in Gaza City on Saturday, August the 23rd, during the evening hours, that housed in an enormous Hamas command center, according to the Israeli Defense Forces, adding that only combatants were inside at the time. Gaza health officials said that 17 people were wounded in the attack. Reuters cited local residents as saying that the building housed some 44 families. Shortly after 8 p.m., rocket warning sirens went off in cities across the Tel Aviv area, from Mushan, Lezan, to Bnei Brak, and to Gabbatayim. Blasts from the Iron Dome interceptions could be heard in the air over Tel Aviv, though the sirens did not sound in the city. There were no reports of injuries or damage. Sirens were also reported shortly after in cities of Shephela in the areas in central Israel. Contacted not long ago after the sirens stopped, the Israeli Defense Forces spokesman office said that only one rocket was fired in the Gush Dan area, and it was intercepted by the Iron Dome. Hamas fired some 250 rockets at Israel over the weekend, killing a four-year-old boy in Nahal Oz and critically wounding a man in the Ashdod region. The mortar round that killed four-year-old Danielle Traegerman on Friday, August the 22nd, was fired from an elementary school in northern Gaza, according to the Israeli Defense Forces. The same school was used to fire 36 projectiles at Israel in August, according to alleged intelligence by the Israeli Defense Forces. Most of the Gazan attacks targeted villages near the border of the Eskal region, among them Shahar HaNegev, the Zadat Negev, and the Haf Ashkelon, which came under heavy rocket and mortar fire on Friday and Saturday, August the 22nd and August the 23rd. The southern cities of Ashdod, Ashkelon, and Beersheba were also targeted. The Israeli Air Force bombed more than 120 targets in Gaza over the weekend, according to the Israeli Defense Forces. Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon visited the local government heads in regions that border Gaza on Saturday, August the 23rd. He said that Israel had no intention of ending the war until it is sure the rocket fire will end. Quote, "This can continue for more time or less, but in the end, I am convinced that the other side in its state needs a ceasefire more than we do. We must see that we are maneuvering from both a diplomatic and military perspective," the Israeli defense minister said. "We are maneuvering this to a place in which we will bring quiet and security for a longer period of time." Yaalon said that the IDF's 5,000 strikes in Gaza all targeted so-called terrorist positions, and none targeted, quote, "open areas," unquote. Hamas has paid a heavy price, according to the Israeli defense minister, and will try as hard as it can to, quote, "explain to the Gazan public that it was worth it." The destruction there is big. Think about the fact that in Gaza, 10,000 structures were completely destroyed, some from our precision attacks on homes. The targets range from Hamas company commanders to the home of Ismail Haniyeh, who is their prime minister. Some of these were their command and control centers, unquote, the Israeli defense minister openly admits in a public statement. Palestinian rocket and mortar fire continued at rapid pace on Saturday, August the 23rd, with around 90 rocket attacks from Gaza into Israel fired by the evening. On Friday, 155 rockets were fired at Israel. Security forces said on Saturday, August the 23rd, that they hit 62 areas in Israel, but all but three of them were in supposedly open areas. In addition, the Army said that the Iron Dome interceptors shot down 9 rockets, including 4 projectiles intercepted in a single salvo in Ashkelon around 6 p.m. The city was targeted again soon afterwards. The Israeli Air Force hit 30 targets across Gaza overnight between Friday, August the 22nd, and Saturday, August the 23rd. Targets included underground rocket launchers, facilities for storing manufacturing weapons, and apartments used to coordinate terrorist attacks, according to the Israeli Defense Forces. Israel killed a so-called terrorist who was traveling in a car in Gaza on Saturday evening, August the 23rd, the Israeli Defense Forces spokesman's office's command confirmed. And as we can see, the war against the people of Gaza, the 1.8 million Palestinians who live in the largest open-air prison in the world, is continuing. And as the Israeli Defense Ministry openly admits, they are destroying Gaza, striking some 10,000 structures inside that enclave, which is essentially and approximately the size of the city of Detroit. And with that, we're going to conclude this segment of the Pan-African Journal discussing the ongoing war by the State of Israel against the Palestinian people in Gaza. We'll be right back with our final reports on developments in the North African state of Libya and the reemergence of a yet another war against the Middle Eastern state of Iraq. Listening to the Pan-African Journal. In the North African state of Libya, fighting is continuing between various militias. One militia claims that it has overrun the airport outside of Tripoli, as well as the city, key areas of the capital of Tripoli. An alliance of Libyan militias claim they have taken full control of the international airport in the capital of Tripoli days after heavy clashes with other rival militiamen in the area have taken place. According to a report issued by Press TV on Saturday, August the 23rd, a group of militias known as Fajr Libya announced that they were in control of Tripoli International Airport, which has remained closed since July the 13th among skirmishes in the area. Over the past weeks, the strategic area situated some 30 kilometers south of Tripoli has witnessed clashes between the Fajr militiamen, partly comprised of men from Misrata, Sintan, who are loyal to the former renegade general Khalifa Haftar. Khalifa Haftar defected from the Libyan military during the 1980s. He was then granted asylum in the United States. He lived in the state of Virginia for well over 25 years. He was supported by the American Central Intelligence Agency. At the initiation of the so-called Libyan counter-revolution of early 2011, the former general and CIA operative Khalifa Haftar was flown back to eastern Libya, ostensibly to head the uprising against the Jemahiriya that was headed by Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. Now, if the claim is confirmed, it would be a major defeat for the Zintan forces that held the airport since the fall of former Libyan revolutionary leader Muammar Gaddafi, who was overthrown in 2011 and brutally assassinated on October 20th of that year. Meanwhile, the Fajr Libyan militias accused the United Arab Emirates and Egypt of having a hand in two airstrikes targeting their positions in Tripoli over the past week. Ahmed Hadia, a spokesman for the militia group, said that 13 of his forces had been killed and 20 others wounded in the second air raid carried out by unknown warplanes on Friday night, August the 22nd. Quote, "We reserve the right to respond at the opportune moment," unquote, said Hadia, adding that Fajr Libya militias believe the country's provisional government and newly elected parliament, quote, are accomplices, unquote, in those raids. Earlier this month, Libya's newly elected parliament asked the United Nations for a military intervention to protect civilians amid relentless clashes. The legislative body also voted to dissolve rival militias, giving them an ultimatum to join the military and police by the end of 2014. Nearly 3 years after the counter-revolution against the Jemahiriya headed by Muammar Gaddafi, the nation of Libya has been virtually destroyed. There is no security. There is no political order. There is no judicial or legal system inside the country. The current state of the situation in Libya can be laid right at the doorstep of U.S. imperialism and its allies within NATO. It was the Central Intelligence Agency that was deployed by President Barack Obama in February of 2011 to destabilize the North African state of Libya and to identify targets to be bombed. It was the United States Pentagon who, beginning on March the 19th of 2011, led and armed, and of course, a aerial bombardment of the North African state of Libya. Approximately 30,000 air missions were flown over the country of 6 million people. And there were 10,000 bombs dropped on the country, killing anywhere between 50 and 100,000 people and displacing some 2 million others. Today, not only is Libya in chaos and in deep distress, but it is a source of destabilization and a source of instability throughout North and West Africa, as well as throughout the entire Middle East. And finally, the United States is embarking upon yet another war in the Middle Eastern nation of Iraq. President Barack Obama deployed hundreds of so-called military advisors several months ago to deal with the situation inside of the Middle Eastern nation of Iraq. And this, of course, has raised serious questions about the intentions of the Obama administration, as the U.S. has acknowledged that the Islamic State group is a greater threat than Al-Qaeda, ostensibly. The White House is reportedly seeking domestic legal justification domestically to use unlimited military force against these so-called Sunni extremists in Iraq and Syria. These are the same forces that the United States fought on the same side of in Syria against the government of President Bashar al-Assad. It is speculated that the Islamic State is funded by Saudi Arabia and other allies in the Persian Gulf monarchies. Of course, if this is true, then it means that the U.S. indirectly supported and built up the ISIS, the ISIL, now known as the Islamic State. On Friday, August the 22nd, the Obama administration said that the killing of American journalist James Foley by the Islamic State militants amounts to a direct terrorist attack on the United States. Quote, we have seen them posing a threat to our interests in the region, to our personnel and facilities in the region, and clearly the brutal execution of Jim Foley represented an affront, an attack, not just on him, he's an American, and we see that as an attack on our country. When one of our own is killed like that, unquote, said Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes. Then comes the day after U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel stressed that the ISIS terrorist organization is so well-funded and managed that it is, quote, beyond anything we've seen, so we must prepare for everything, unquote. Sounds familiar? We've heard this before. We've heard it in relationship to developments in the Persian Gulf during 1990 and 1991, as the U.S. imperialists prepared for a massive aerial assault and ground invasion against Kuwait and Iraq. We heard it again in 2001 as the United States prepared for massive bombing and a ground invasion and occupation of Afghanistan, which still exists to this day. We heard it in 2002 and in 2003 as the United States government under George W. Bush attempted to link the 9/11 attacks to the government in Iraq, then under Saddam Hussein. Here we are again, on the verge of another major military operation in the Middle Eastern nation of Iraq. And with that, we're going to conclude this edition of the Pan-African Journal. In concluding this edition of the Pan-African Journal, we'd like to recap the major stories in the Pan-African Journal for this week. In the city of Ferguson, Missouri, the funeral of 18-year-old Michael Brown was scheduled for Monday, August the 25th. Demonstrations have occurred in Ferguson for over 2 weeks, and they have spread throughout the United States. The North African state of Libya, 3 years after the CIA, Pentagon, and NATO war against that North African state, is in a complete status of chaos. Islamic militias have overrun the international airport in Tripoli and are claiming to control large swaths of territory in the capital of Tripoli. The Israeli Defense Forces continue their war against the people of Gaza. Over 2,000 have been reported killed since early July. And the United States government under Barack Obama is escalating its military operations against the military, against the Middle Eastern nation of Iraq, opening up yet another war in that region of the world. And we'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire, which the Pan-African Journal is largely based upon, is an international electronic press service designed to foster intelligent discussion on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998 and has published thousands of articles and dispatches in newspapers and magazines and journals and research reports on blogs and on websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. And if you want to log on to the Pan-African Newswire, all you have to do is go to the following URL, and that's at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. This is Abayomi Azikwe signing off, and have a beautiful week. That was the New York City version of the Pan-African Journal, hosted by yours truly, Abayomi Azikwe, and produced by Bernard White of Community Progressive Radio in New York City. And we'd like to thank you once again for tuning in to the Pan-African Journal for this week. And we'll be right back with more of the Pan-African Journal. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. And the Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. And we're listening to the sound of Miles Davis live from the early 1970s. And this weekend, we are broadcasting in tribute to the Detroit International Jazz Festival. This year represents the 35th consecutive year of the sponsoring of the Detroit International Jazz Festival. And during the course of the commemorations this weekend, which is Labor Day weekend in the United States, there will be a musical tribute to the late, great Miles Davis. It's put on by Wayne Shorter, legendary saxophonist who played with Miles Davis during the 1960s and 1970s. This tribute will be held on Sunday, August the 31st, from 9:30 to 10:45 p.m. In downtown Detroit at the amphitheater stage on the river in Hart Plaza. And it's entitled To Miles from Wayne, featuring the Wallace Mini Orchestra and, of course, Wayne Shorter's Universe and other fairly heard jazz works. And so we're here once again this year commemorating and participating in the Detroit International Jazz Festival. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. If you want to have access to this program as well as other programs of the Pan-African Journal, through the Pan-African Radio Network, all you have to do is log on to the Pan-African Radio Network. And that is at blogtalkradio.com blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. By logging on to that website, you can listen to this program again, have access to this program, and also other archived editions of the Pan-African Journal, over 400 in number. And we want to encourage all of our listeners to share these broadcasts with other potential listeners via email, by hosting them on other blogs and websites, and also by posting them on social networks, social media mechanisms such as Facebook and Twitter. This is Abayomi Ezekwe, and we'll be right back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week.
MXGM, they have kept Malcolm's story and his ideas alive among younger generations. They have also provided critical, psychological, political, and material support for black political prisoners in New York State and nationally, including former members of the Black Panther Party, the Black Liberation Army, and other formations of the Black Freedom Movement. In the spirit of black resistance, their living example shines like stars in the summer night, guiding us closer and closer to the land we don't yet know, freedom. Herman and Ayalawa Ferguson, we salute y'all. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And that was Mumia Abu-Jamal, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. And today is Saturday, August 30th, 2014. We're broadcasting live from our studios here in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to the Pan-African Journal for this week. Zikwe. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. We just heard the sound of jazz legend Kenny Durham. Yes, jazz trumpeter Kenny Durham with the tune entitled Spring Shuffle. And as we mentioned earlier, we're broadcasting simultaneously with the Detroit International Jazz Festival that takes place every single year over Labor Day weekend here in the United States. And this weekend, there is going to be numerous jazz artists, including a tribute to Miles Davis. It's going to be people such as Wallace Rooney, Joshua Redman, who is the artist in residence for this 35th annual Detroit International Jazz Festival. He opened up the festival last evening. There's going to be presentations as well from the Lou Donaldson Organ Quartet, as well as Billy Harper and none other than the one and only, of course, jazz legend Randy Weston. And we here at the Pan-African Journal will be attending, as last evening, the Detroit International Jazz Festival, located near where we're broadcasting from in downtown Detroit. Earlier in the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal, we brought you information about the ongoing political and security crisis in the Southern African nation of Lesotho. Right now, we want to listen in to South Africa FM radio news reports on developments throughout the entire Southern Africa region. Let's listen in.
Top stories: Lesotho's army surrounds police station in Maseru and Kenya takes action on drug trafficking. Good morning with SAFM News at 7. I'm Lulu Gabu. The Lesotho army has surrounded a police station in the capital, Maseru. A police officer has confirmed that they are barricaded. Residents at Hamabode, where a special operation unit is based, say they have heard an exchange of gunfire. ANC Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa has likened the National Development Plan with the Freedom Charter of 1956. Ramaphosa was the keynote speaker at a gala dinner hosted by the ANC Progressive Business Forum last night. He said South Africans have always had a vision for their future, and the current blueprint now lies with the NDP. He says implementation of the NDP will solve many of the challenges the country faces.
Is there corruption in government? Yes, there is corruption. What are we going to do? We're going to tackle that, and we're going to eliminate corruption. Is there going to be accountability in government? Yes, there will be accountability. Will there be consequences? Yes, there will be consequences. So this plan, ladies and gentlemen, has with embedded in it the various tools and solutions that we can utilize to address a number of key problems that face our country.
Labour Federation COSATU has admitted that trade unions in South Africa are in a state of paralysis and are not meeting workers' needs. COSATU General Secretary Zwelinzima Mavavi has told a FAWU Congress in Johannesburg that workers' issues are being sidelined, even by COSATU. Vavi says 38% of workers join unions because they want to be protected from unfair dismissal, while a further 33% join because they want to improve their income. He says if unions are unable to deliver, they don't deserve the union fee that workers pay them. Over 70% of workers do not belong to a union, and Vavi says one of the reasons for the decline in membership is that unions place too much focus on politics. The process to relocate rhino from the Kruger National Park is underway. Environmental Affairs Minister Edna Mulewa earlier announced that around 500 rhinos would either be sold or relocated to other parks in an attempt to curb poaching. SANParks spokesperson Reynold Takuli says small numbers of the animals are being relocated. Takuli says some are being sold to hunting farms.
The minister has put together a number of resources out there where ordinary South Africans or people with interest in national parks management are actually playing a role. Within the national parks themselves, you have what you call the Park Management Forum, which consists of ordinary South Africans who are making sure that these national parks are actually managed with their consent. So we've been doing this all along. Really, it's nothing new, And we'll continue doing it. We are managing these national parks on behalf of South Africans. And therefore, on a daily basis, in terms of operations, we have people in conservation at heart and in our duties as well.
A Muslim woman, Khadija Isaacs, has successfully challenged the right to stay in her marital home after her ex-husband attempted to evict her from a house that she had resided in for 13 years. The home had been registered in his name only because their marriage was not legally recognized. The Goodwood Magistrates Court in Cape Town ruled that the woman and her children were allowed to stay on. The Women's Legal Center spokesperson, Huda Abraham-Sfaika, says the judge acknowledge the marginalization that Muslim women face.
This case is very significant and has made inroads because Muslim women, they are marginalized and discriminated against as opposed to other women because their marriages are not legally recognized. Had she been married in terms of South African law or in terms of customary law, she would have been deemed to be a joint owner of that property.
And finally, the Kenyan Navy has sunk a ship which was seized while carrying drugs worth millions of rand to the coastal city of Mombasa. The consignment of heroin is valued at over 100 million rand. President Uhuru Kenyatta ordered the sinking of the drug vessel to show his government's seriousness in the war against drug trafficking. Sarah Kimani reports.
Friday on the Indian Ocean, the Kenya Navy is on a mission to destroy the largest consignments of drugs ever seized in Mombasa. This after an executive order by the country's president, Uhuru Kenyatta. We will sink the ship and its contents. We do not care who owns it. We are tired of those who come here to destroy our children, says Kenyatta.
Recapping the top story, the Lesotho Army has surrounded a police station in the capital, Maseru. For SAFM News, I'm Lulu Gabu. More news at 7:30.
And that was a report from SAFM News in the Republic of South Africa dealing with the number of issues taking place in the region, as well as other parts of Africa and the world. And another updated report from SAFM News also gives additional information on developments in Lesotho. Let's listen in.
Thank you, Manda. In our top stories, Lesotho military seized police headquarters in Maseru and talks to continue in Milan on Ukraine crisis. Good morning. Lesotho's military has seized control in a possible coup of the tiny African kingdom's police headquarters and jammed radio stations and phones. The armed forces have taken the headquarters of the police. Residents have been advised to stay off the streets. Ntakwana Ngatana reports.
From 3 a.m., heavily armed soldiers started arriving at the police headquarters and the Mabote police station, where Police Special Operations is based. They also reinforced army guards at the Prime Minister's residence and the Deputy Prime Minister's residence. No one is allowed in or out of these places, and local radio stations, which transmit through the Lesotho National Broadcasting Service, are off air. Sources close to Prime Minister Thabane say he was intending to fire Army Boss Thadi Kamudi and replace him with Brigadier Maabarangwe Mahau, but the army says it is not aware of this development. Ntakwana Ngatani, SABC News, Maseru, Lesotho.
Meanwhile, Lesotho's ruling All Basotho Convention, ABC, has rejected claims by the military that its Under the Tree Army, UTTA, was intending to get arms from the police. Prime Minister's spokesperson Thabo Takalikwala says one of eight officers wanted for the January bombings on the house of the Prime Minister's girlfriend and the police commissioner is a rogue element intending to smear the ABC with lies. Takalikwala explains.
The Prime Minister is also the Minister of Defense, and the commander of the Lesotho Defense Force is directly answerable to the Prime Minister. Now, the situation we have right now in Lesotho is that the former, when I say the former, I'm talking about the man who claims to be the commander of the Lesotho Defense Force right now, because he has been removed. He's a renegade. He's a loose cannon who has decided not to take any instructions from the Prime Minister. Hence, you see what is happening right now in the country.
Back on home soil, government, business, labor and civil society need to enter into a social compact to implement the National Development Plan forward. This was the message of Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa to business people attending the ANC Progressive Business Forum presidential dinner in Sandton, Johannesburg last night. He reminded those gathered of a meeting of all sectors promised by President Jacob Zuma in his State of the Nation address earlier this year.
Right now, there is a trust deficit between business and government. There is a trust deficit between business and labor. There's a trust deficit between communities and business and all that. We have identified what the problem is. We now need to go bed down and start addressing the problems and the challenges that we face in this regard.
A new model of water tariff determination could bring a significant adjustment in tariffs countrywide if it is implemented. The aim of the proposed system would be to achieve greater equity in tariffs across the country. Acting Director General of the Department of Water and Sanitation, Trevor Bowser, says they are hoping to reduce water tariffs across the country.
What we're trying to do with the raw water tariffs is to try and bring equity in the range of tariffs that we have in place at the moment. What we are looking at in the new policy is to have either a national tariff where you would have a single tariff across the entire country. We're trying to make sure that whichever way the increases go, we stick within the guidelines which we use at the moment, which is to limit the increases, producer price index percentage annually.
And finally, further afield, European Union foreign ministers are due to hold a second day of discussions in the Italian city of Milan about the crisis in Ukraine. The German foreign minister, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, has warned that the situation is slipping out of control.
All the hopes we had that direct talks between President Poroshenko and President Putin would contribute to de-escalating the situation have been disappointed. Instead, the border infringements we've observed have intensified and have raised concerns that the situation is slipping out of control. This needs to stop, especially if we want to avoid direct military confrontation between Ukrainian and Russian forces.
Recapping our top story, Lesotho's military has seized control in a possible coup of the tiny African kingdom's police headquarters and jammed radio stations and phones. For SAFM News, I'm Lulu Gabu. More news at 11.
And that was SAFM News from the Republic of South Africa discussing the developments in Lesotho in South Africa, as well as the ongoing conflict in the southeast of Ukraine between the U.S.-backed government in Kiev and those allied with the Russian Federation. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe. And right now we're going to hear the final report from SAFM News, updating us on developments in the southern African nation of Lesotho, as well as other issues.
South Africa's news and information leader.
Thank you, Mandla. In our top stories, Lesotho military seized police headquarters in Maseru and Orthodox Jewish community forced out of village in Guatemala. Good morning. Lesotho's military has seized control in a possible coup of the tiny African kingdom's police headquarters. The armed forces have taken the headquarters of the police. Residents have been advised to stay off the streets, Ntakwanangadana reports.
From 3 a.m., heavily armed soldiers started arriving at the police headquarters and the Mabote police station, where Police Special Operations is based. They also reinforced army guards at the Prime Minister's residence and the Deputy Prime Minister's residence. No one is allowed in or out of these places, and local radio stations which transmit through the Lesotho National Broadcasting Service are off air. Sources close to Prime Minister Thabane say he was intending to fire Army boss Tadika Moody and replace him with Brigadier Maabarangwe Mahau, but the army says it is not aware of this development. Itakwana ngatani, SABC News, Maseru, Lesotho.
Meanwhile, the South African Department of International Relations and Cooperation says it is still ascertaining facts about the situation in Lesotho and will release a statement later. The South African Weather Services says KwaZulu-Natal will continue to experience cold weather conditions this weekend. Last night, certain areas in the Drakensberg region in the provincial Midlands experienced light snowfalls. South African Weather Services senior forecaster Wiseman Dlamini says there is also a warning issued for high seas.
Yesterday we had a cold front that passed through over KZN, and this is what gave us very cold conditions, as well as some snowfalls over the Drakensberg region. And again today, the front is off the east coast, but we're still experiencing very strong winds that are reaching about 80 kilometers per hour along the KZN coast for today. There is a warning out for high seas that are between 6 to 9 meters between Eastland and Maputo for today. It will be very cold over the Drakensberg region today, with temperatures reaching about 8 to 10 degrees.
Opposition parties in the Northwest have welcomed Premier Supra Mahumapilu's announcement that a forensic investigation unit will be formed to probe corruption and fraud within the provincial departments. Mahumapilu made the announcement when he presented his budget earlier this week. He says the unit will be fully functional before the end of the financial year. The Public Works, Health and the Parks and Tourism Boards will be closely scrutinized. EFF leader in the legislature, Alfred Mutsi, had this to say.
We acknowledge the budget speech from his office and the fact that he reiterated that he's going to establish the forensic investigation team in his office and also to bring all the forensic investigation reports for the past 5 years. Because we know for sure that some of the people who are implicated in those reports are powerful people within the ANC faction within the province. Now, he made an undertaking that he will definitely bring those reports in the legislature for discussion.
A man has been killed when he lost control of his motorcycle in Benoni, east of Johannesburg. Netcare 911 spokesperson Santi Steinman says the 24-year-old was declared dead on the scene in the early hours of this morning. The cause of the accident is not known. And finally, further afield, an Orthodox Jewish community has been forced out of a village in Guatemala, where it settled after coming into conflict with the authorities in Canada, its original homeland. The group is known as the Lev Tahoe community. The BBC's Candice Pete reports.
The 230 members of the Lev Tahoe community were asked to leave after meetings with village elders. The elders said they had a right to protect their Mayan indigenous culture and accused the Jews of discriminating against them and of imposing their religion and customs. For their part, the Lev Tahoe members, who practice an austere form of Judaism and dress their women in long black cloaks like Muslim burqas, said they'd received verbal abuse and threats to eject them by force. Many of the Jewish group had been living in the village for 6 years.
Recapping the top story, Lesotho's military has seized control in a possible coup of the tiny African kingdom's police headquarters. For SAFM News, I'm Lulu Gabu. More news at noon.
And that was SAFM News from the Republic of South Africa. And, of course, we've been following developments in the Southern African nation of Lesotho, as well as other stories throughout the African continent, the African diaspora, and indeed the international community in general. If you're interested in following these breaking stories, just log on to the Pan-African Newswire. That can be reached at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And right now we're going to be winding down the Pan-African Journal for this week. We'd like to remind our listeners that this program, as well as other archived editions of the Pan-African Journal, can be accessed by merely logging on to the Pan-African Radio Network. That URL is blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And we're going to be covering throughout the weekend the Detroit International Jazz Festival, and we'll be back with additional broadcast throughout this weekend here at the Pan-African Journal, broadcasting live from downtown Detroit. This is Abayomi Ezekwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.
Thank you.